This is Parshas Vayishlach, which deals with the encounter of Yaakov Avinu finally meeting his brother Esav after these 20 years, or at least 20 years, perhaps 34 years, of separation. As we know, the Parsha begins with all the preparation Yaakov Avinu makes in the encounter with his brother, who's coming to greet him with 400 people. He really does a three-level plan: gifts, splitting up his group into two, preparation for war, and clearly what we all need in difficult times is tefillah, is prayer. And what we have is, right after Yaakov Avinu brings over his whole entourage over the Nahar Yabok, we find that Yaakov Avinu is left alone that evening, and he has that famous wrestling match with the angel, which Mir Hashem will speak about today, and he comes out victorious from that incident and finally meets Esav, and they embrace, however you want to understand that kissing, which is with the dots on top of Vayishakehu, to be understood either he had a change of heart, or God, Medrash says, made Yaakov's neck into marble. Be that as it may, they meet each other, they speak basically on pleasant terms, and Esav invites Yaakov to be with him, and Yaakov says, you know, you return to Har Seir, and I'll get there eventually. And that's clearly a reference to Achris HaYamim, the Haftorah of there will be a day that we will get to Har Seir, times of Mashiach, when we will vanquish the enemy of Edom. Parsha then goes on to tell us about the story of Dina being raped by Shechem and that whole incident, which is a very, very troubling incident. And then we have the birth of Binyamin, the death of Rachel Imenu, and then basically the list of the descendants of Esav. In looking at this Parsha, I ask myself a very simple question. Is there perhaps a theme that runs throughout the Parsha? Is there a motif that we could discuss and try to take this idea and apply it to our lives? So the idea that I came up with, that I like to suggest together, is the idea of names. We find throughout the Parsha that people are getting name changes as well as places are getting name changes. So to do a quick run through the Parsha, we begin with Yaakov's name immediately being changed from Yaakov to Yisrael in the encounter with the angel. And then right afterwards, he calls that place of the encounter Penuel, that I have fought with God, I have seen God. And then after Yaakov meets Esav, it says that he went to Sukkot, he built a house for himself, we'll speak about this as well, and he built a Sukkot for his cattle, and he named the place Sukkot. And then he named the place where he saw God. And then he named the place where Rivka, the Dvorah Meineket Rivka dies, Alon Bachut. And then he names the place where he meets God, Beit El. And then he names, ultimately, the end of the Parsha, the son who Rachel names Ben-Oni, he names Binyamin. So it seems that throughout the Parsha we have this concept of a lot of names of people as well as places are being named. So I'd like to try to present today, it's an interesting approach, is what is the significance of these names, of these places and people, and what lesson can we draw from them for our lives? And I think the point of departure is a very fascinating insight of the Orga Dayahu at the beginning of Parashat Shemot. And I think it really gives us an insight on what life is about. It says in Source 1, Umevu'ar ki shemot ha-nivra'im ke'heim kifi kocholtehem v'tafkidehem. So we've spoken about many times, a person's name is really their kochos, their strengths, and their tafkid, their job in life. And this is what our rabbis mean. They learn out of Pasuk in Gemara and Brachos, of the Pasuk says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you can see the greatness of God, Asher Sam Shamot Ba'aretz, that He brought destruction into the world. Don't read it as destruction, but rather read it as Shamot, as Shemot, as names. Says Yoga Dayahu, what's this play? Shamot, destruction, Shemot, names, but this is the essence of names. Well, you see in Judaism how one name can mean two different things. Like Shorish means to root something. Lahashrish means to uproot something. Well, you can have one name with exact opposite meanings. And that's what Shemot and Shamot mean. Shemot means a name, it means the essence, it means building. Shamot means destruction. That is really in our hands. You can take your name and build something with yourself, or Chas v'Shalom, you can take your essence and really destroy one's life. Like when we talk about somebody, and we talk about them in a negative sense, we say Yimach Shemam, their names should be erased, because their names are their essence. That's what they're all about. When a person loses their names, they lose what their essence is about. Names, therefore, represent a challenge for us that we're able to utilize our name, our essence, for the positive, and not to cause that very name, to cause our very essence to be a destructive force within this world. Where you see this duality, where you come into play with names, I think you clearly see in the name of Binyamin. We know if in source number 2, when Rachel finally, you know, is at really her point of her last breath, and the midwife says, don't worry, this too is the son. So right before she died, as her soul was departing, she died, she called his name Ben-Oni. And his father called him Binyamin. Very interesting understanding, what is Ben-Oni, what is Binyamin? So we take a look at the writings of Nachmanides, the Ramban in source number 3. He says the word own can signify grief, suffering, or mourning, but the same word can mean right, strength, or success. Now, just as Rachel, after Rachel had given her son a name, accentuating the pessimistic signification of the word Aven, son of my sorrow, Yaakov decided to substitute the optimistic meaning in order to protect the child from any bad omen. The interpretation or the personal meaning which one attaches to the facts and events of existence are among life's imponderables, but it would be wrong to neglect them as well. This is, I think, the crux that I'd like to deal with today, the theme I'd like to deal with today. How one name, Binyamin, could be Ben-Oni, it could be a depressing aspect, or you can take that very same name and turn it into Binyamin with the same meaning, which means strength, which means vitality, which has the ability to move onward. And that really is the challenge within our name and what we represent. Every single name can be used positively or negatively. Our challenge is to use the world around us to find the positive and not the negative. So I'd like to share together three names in this week's parsha. Three incidences where names are given, and to really use them as gauges on how to utilize our names and our lives on the uphill battle of the positive and not, God forbid, the opposite. The first and probably the most famous is the struggle of Yaakov and the angel. Let's take a look at the text. Where Yaakov was left alone, source 4, and a man wrestled him until the break of dawn. When he perceived that he could not overcome him, he struck the socket of his hip. So Jacob's hip socket was dislocated as he wrestled with it. And then he said, let me go, for dawn has broken. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He said to him, what is your name? He replied, Jacob. He said, no longer will it be said that your name is Yaakov, but Israel, for you have striven with the divine and with man and have overcome. Then Yaakov inquired, and he said, divulge, if you please, your name. And he said, why then do you inquire my name? And he blessed him there. There are zillions of interpretations on this text. And I'm not coming to tell you chidushim here today. But I still think that the approach I'd like today, to take today will give us perhaps another layer, another insight of this very, very beautiful but enigmatic story. Before I begin, I can't but resist to share a chasam sofer. I never knew that Mefarshim could have a sense of humor, but I couldn't resist but breaking into laughter and reading this. So I'm going to depart from our agenda for a half a minute and share this Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer says in Source 5, what does it mean when the angel said, why are you asking my name? Incredible Chasam Sofer. He says, 2 minutes before, the angel asked Yaakov, what's your name? And he said, my name is Yaakov. He said, no, your name isn't Yaakov. You fought with me and you won, so now your name is what? Yisrael. He says, but don't ask me my name, because what just happened to me? I lost. And if you ask me my name, what am I afraid you're going to do? You're going to say, your name isn't that anymore. Now that you've lost, I'm going to change your name into a negative connotation. Okay, be that as it may. That's why he didn't want to divulge his name, so Yaakov Avinu shouldn't in any way change his name. Because again, the name is the essence. Leaving the Chasam Sofer aside for the moment, I mean, to think about, I'd like to share together an essay found in Rabbi Lev's book, Outlooks and Insights on the Parsha. I'd like to really go through it in depth because I think it has, for us, the first signpost in our struggle in life. He says in Source 6, a society in which technology enables us to deal effortlessly with many of life's difficulty raises the issue of the value of the challenges and struggles. The Torah's view on this question lies at the center of the account of the struggle between Yaakov and the angel. We know that there are different midrashim, exactly who was this angel that came to fight with Yaakov Avinu. Perhaps the most famous approach, that it was the archangel of Esav, the Satan himself, the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, evil itself came to fight with Yaakov. However, there's another interpretation that it was a positive angel, it was Michal. Explains Rabbi Lev, developing this midrash in 7, during the struggle, the angel took on different disguises. According to one opinion, he came as a Talmid Chacham. Another opinion says he came as a robber. How do we understand these two levels? My friends, this is where really the struggles of life are at. Sometimes a person wants to elevate himself, but something stands in his way. That is the Satan, the robber, who seeks to deny the person what he wants. That denial is to challenge him and cause him to appreciate all the more his accomplishments. But on the other hand, and those challenges we're very well aware of in life, but on the other hand, there's the angel who tries to pull a person up when he wants to stay put, and that is Michal, the Talmid Chacham. Where Yaakov wanted to avoid problems, Michal forced a struggle upon him in order to elevate him higher. And I think this is a very important insight in life. It's not always when we're struggling in life, it's a struggle to Satan. Sometimes we reach a plateau in life where we don't want to move higher. And there is that struggle where we are presented opportunities in life, and I think all of us, whether it's on our family level or we've all experienced this perhaps professionally as well, where we're thrust upon another job, another challenge in life, and we say, we can't possibly do this. What do you want from me? But you're told, well, you have no choice. Just do it. And then when we do it and we accomplish, and it's difficult, and we go through a struggle, and we come out victorious, that's the Michal. That's Michal fighting with us and saying, you know what? You can push yourself further. You can strive higher. You can move further and further in life. And this is really the aspect of Yaakov and the angel. In source 9, at the end of the night, the angel asked to be set free, but Yaakov refused. While at the beginning of the night, Yaakov sought to avoid the confrontation, by night's end, he realized that the struggle was essential to his very existence. And why did the angel want to go? He wanted to sing to God. His time to sing only comes in the morning. As Rav Dessler explains, that's when an angel fulfills its purpose. That is the song it sings. The angel, whether it be Satan or Michal, exists to give us the chance to fight and be successful. And when we are successful, then the angel too has fulfilled his mission, and he too wants to sing a song to God. In light of this, we can understand why the angel did not tell Yaakov his name. Because angels' names change with their function. Yaakov's struggle represents all struggles Jews have faced and will face throughout history. Each man's struggles in life are different depending on his unique nature. What is easy for one is difficult for another. This story, therefore, is not just a story of Yaakov fighting with an angel, it's a story of our lives. It's a story of our lives where we fight with either the Satan or Michal in different aspects of our lives. That's why there's no name for this angel. Because the angel, a name which represents essence, there are so many different essences to this angel, depending on the different struggles that we go through in life. But here's the key. How are we successful in these struggles? How are we able to overcome these struggles? 10, where does the person derive the power to carry on in these struggles? So he says, we have this power from the pasuk of Yaakov remained alone, which is also the same idea as referred to about God, because both Hashem and Israel possess the quality of being alone. No outside power has an effect on God. Nothing adds or subtracts from his essence. A Jew has the power to a certain degree to emulate Hashem in this respect. If a person has the inner strength of character and knows who he is, then nothing external, no problem or challenge can deter him. He recognizes that all external obstacles are just that, external. He remains strong, for his essence remains untouched. Is this not the key of life? That no matter what we go through, if we know who we are, if we know what life is all about, going back, if we know what our name, what our essence is about, so yes, we have struggles in life, and yes, they could be very long and difficult struggles, but it's never going to change us. Our mahut, our essence of who we are, will nevertheless be able to be successful. And that is how he explains the fact that the malach touched him on the thigh. Why the thigh of all places? It's such a fascinating question. There's so many approaches among the mefarshim. So says Rabbi Leff so beautifully, he says, at this point, the Malach really thought that perhaps Yaakov was like an angel. Here he was, struggling, and yet not letting go. What's the difference between angels and humans? Is that angels do not have a hip joint. They cannot sit. An angel is always ready for action. Angels are always known as omdim, as those that stand. They never sit. They're always ready to move. Consequently, what does that really mean, not sitting? He never becomes depressed or overwhelmed. What is sitting all about? You can't move. You have this inability to go on. We've all experienced this, my friends. A human does not have this ability. He can be overwhelmed by situation, causing him to give up, sit down in an activity. The angel struck Yaakov in the hip joint and saw that he was a man. Yaakov was wounded. He had failed a little, but he did not give up and become depressed. Because he knew who he was and what he was, he can overcome. The pasuk says that tzaddik can fall 7 times, but yet overcome in each and every time. And the Torah gives us a constant reminder of Yaakov's struggle. The prohibition on eating the gid hanasha, the sciatic nerve. The Sforno explains that we thereby show that the place where Yaakov was wounded is not important. That is how a person must deal with failure. When you fail in one area, you cannot become depressed over it. What's the gid hanasha? Nothing important. We throw it away. Every time a person refrains from eating the gid hanasha, he's reminded not to be overwhelmed by adversity. Life is about moving on. Life is about carrying forward. Life is not about getting depressed and taking the setbacks of life and saying we can't move. And this is how explained so beautifully based on Rav Dessler, that the word ra, evil, if you turn around the letters, is the word air, to be awakened. Where everything in life, failure itself, is the incentive to rise and to continue. Where the negative in life can be used in a positive way. Setbacks and obstacles in a person's life are not there to immobilize the person, but to challenge and strengthen a person to move on. And that's why Yaakov now gets, going back to our main thing today, the name Yisrael. Because Yisrael means somebody who has fought with an angel. He's come face to face with God. The struggle is the essence of the name Yisrael, where you're able to be victorious. It says, if that Yaakov is the struggle itself, where it's the Yaakov holding on to the heel of his brother. Well, Yaakov represents the struggle. Yisrael represents the ability to face God, the ability to overcome the struggle. And that's why we mention Yaakov and Yisrael's name are always used interchangeably throughout the Tanakh, because this is what life is about. We're not always Yisrael. We're not always on top. Very often in life where the Yaakovs were struggling. But this is the key. Even when we struggle, we need to understand that as a nation, we're Yisrael. We're called the B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, not the B'nai Yaakov. Because ultimately, no matter how much we may struggle, how much Yaakovs we may have in life, if we understand that by the essence we are Yisrael, if by the essence the Jew is one who's come out victorious, and that whatever happens in life is not trying to overwhelm us, it's trying for us to grow, it's an opportunity to push us beyond. So if we always keep in mind that as a result of this struggle, we throw away the gid hanasha, we don't focus in on setbacks, and we focus in on the name Yisrael, which Yaakov was given at this point, so we remember no matter how far down we are in life, we always have that vision of Yisrael to keep us going. And that's how the Klal Yoker explains the name Yisrael. He says, it's Lashon Yashar Kel, and Yashar is Lashon Re'iyah, Milashon Ashurenu Velo Karo. Yisrael means to see God, to have that ability to perceive God and to really to overcome all obstacles and to go beyond and see the focus and see the goal. And I think this is perhaps also echoed in a very famous Medrash in Source 16, where Rabbi Yannai said, God associated his name with Yisrael. This is like a king who has a small key to open the door of his palace. He says to himself, I'll lose the key if I leave it as it is, so I'll attach a string to it in order to find it more easily if it gets lost. God did the same for Jewry. If I leave Jewry alone, he said, this people will become lost among the nations. But I shall attach my name to Jewry so this people can survive. And that's the concept of God's name being added, of the only one of the Avos having God's name in them, of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Yisrael has God's name in it so that we'll never get lost among the nations. It's that string attached to the key where God will always find us, we'll always be able to connect back to God. If this is true on a universal level, I think it's absolutely true and essential on a personal level. That no matter what we go through in life, remember we're always attached to that key, to the string, to God. And that whenever we go through in life, we should have this imagery in mind of Yaakov being able to be successful and being called Yisrael. If we understand that Yashar Kel, they were able to see God, able to see that we can be victorious in life. Look back on our previous victories and understand that God is with us. That God is with us in our troubles, then we're able to hold on to that string and pull ourselves out of these struggles. So I think this is level number one. the level of Yaakov and Yisrael. We could live our whole lives as Yaakov, our whole lives depressed, our whole lives sitting back and saying, one struggle after another, we'll never make it. I think challenge number one in life is to be able to utilize a name positively, is to go beyond the Yaakov to the Yisrael, to go beyond the struggles to say we can be victorious. We have to get up, although he's limping, he gets up and marches onward. And that's our struggle in life, to march onward. And that's why it's no accident that Yaakov names the place, and the end of verse is source 4, so Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I've seen the divine face to face, yet my life was spared. The sun rose for him as he passed Peniel and was limping on his hip. If we can keep this in mind, the ability to see God, then we can move on, even though we're limping, until we can be ultimately healed. That's name number one, the struggle of Yaakov and Yisrael. The struggle of Yaakov and Yisrael. Name number two is a name of a place. Yaakov and Esav meet, they embrace, and they go on their merry way. The very next verse, after Yaakov and Esav separate, is source 17. On that day, Esav returned along the way to Seir, and Jacob went to Sukkot. So Esav goes back home to Seir, have a nice life, good. Yaakov goes to Sukkot. There he built himself a house and made shelters for his livestock. He therefore named the place Sukkot Shelter. You look at this story and you say to yourself, what's going on here? He builds a house for himself, and he builds these temporary shelters for his cattle, and yet names the place what? Sukkot. So first of all, I would have thought we would name the place not after our cattle, but after people. So I thought we would name the place Bayit, or something along that line. We have all these Beit Els and Beit this and Beit that, so we have another Bayit. The second thing is, why is the Torah even telling us that he named the place Sukkot, and particularly what is significant that right after Yaakov and Esav leave, at the first place that Yaakov Avinu goes to, it's a place called Sukkot. So here, again, the Matnat Chaim of Matityahu Chaim Salomon, the Lakewood Mashkiach, in the Moadim section, offers a fascinating, fascinating insight into the symbolism of Sukkot, and it once again offers us the challenge within a name to be able to be successful. He says, let's back up one second to look at the whole story from a whole different vantage point before we get back to Sukkot. Let's start at the beginning of the story. The beginning of the story itself, says the Matnat Chaim, is a little bit troubling. We know that Yaakov was left alone. Very famous Medrash. Well, why was Yaakov left alone when the angel came to encounter with him? So as the Shabbat Shirim Rabbi Miller points out in English in 18, Rashi explains that the reason for his remaining alone was that he crossed back over the river in order to collect some little jars that he had forgotten, these pachim ktanim. And from this, the Gemara deduces the enigmatic principle that the righteous love their money more than themselves, a love resulting from the fact that it had been honestly gained. And perhaps a play on words as a midrashic support, instead of livado, that he was left by himself, read likado, he was left for his jars. So what does this mean? Difficult to understand that the love of property, this is what Judaism is all about. You put yourself in danger because you love the property that you have. So the Matnat Chaim quotes a very fascinating Reb Chaim Vital, which is based on the Ari. So we know it's a little bit Kabbalistic. That's okay. In source 20, he says, "Vinei chaviv aleihem amonam, their money is so beloved to them, ki liyot shenishvam milamala eino ra'ui shim aspo." Since they understand that all the money they have is directly given from above, so therefore they take special consideration with it. If it wasn't meant for him, so what had been given to him? This object from God. He went back for these items. Because if he didn't go back, as if he was saying, I don't want them, I don't need them. The chol davar nishvam milamala, anything that comes from above, sarich lahader alav, he should really treat properly. Lachein chazar larochi chaviva alav, therefore he went back for them. The mashal that the Matnat Chaim gives, which I think is a very sweet mashal, to explain this, Reb Chaim Vital, is of an individual who's very, very, very poor. And he davens to God, and he says, God, I am so poor, and I would just like to do the mitzvah of Netilat Yadayim. If I could only have a cup and a basin, would I be so thrilled? And sure enough, he wakes up the next morning, and what is by his bedside? A cup and a basin. Wow, am I excited here. I have the opportunity to do the mitzvah and tiyat yadayim. And over time, this individual becomes very, very wealthy. Very, very wealthy. And one day, he decides to move. So he hires these moving men, and they move all his possessions from one place to another. Before he pays them, he says, let me just make sure everything got moved. So as he's checking everything out, he says, hold on a second. Something's missing here. So they said, no, we moved everything. No, something's missing. Went back to the first house and went all around looking, and sure enough, what did he find? The cup in the basin. They said, you're crazy. You made such a big deal about this cup and basin. It's worthless. It's worth pennies. We'll go out and buy it for you. Here, you're draining us the cup. You're not paying us till you find this cup and basin. He says, you don't understand. This is not just a cup and basin. This cup and basin was given to me as a present from God. Of course I'm going to go after this cup and basin. I'll do anything because this cup and basin are so, so important to me, so, so crucial for my life. This is the way a tzaddik views money. They view it as mamish, a gift from God, and therefore everything they have, they view with respect that this is really something that we need in order to serve God. As the Manachaim points out so beautifully in 21, he says, the Rishayim chaviv aleihem amonam. The Rishayim also value money, but it's not their money that they value, it's the money of others that they really value. And how can they take the money of others? We're clearly talking about a person who gains their money in a proper way, not by cheating, not by stealing. So if you're really an honest person and you deal honestly in your business dealings, so that all the money that you get, you understand is really something given to you from God, and you will treat it that way. Now, having understood this as an introduction, it's like an introduction to an introduction to an introduction, but we'll get to the main point. He says we can now understand the difference between Yaakov and Esav. And he quotes a very famous medrash that when Yaakov and Esav were in the womb, they decided, you know what, let's split the world. There are two worlds, it's Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. We'll split it 50-50. You, Esav, like this world and the physical aspects of this world, you get this world. And I'll take the next world. I'll only use physical things in this world as they allow me to get to the next world. Now, comes along Yaakov with all these wives, all these children, all these wealth. Esav turns to him and says, Yaakov, my dear brother, I thought we split this world 50-50. You're getting the next world, I'm getting this world. And that's what the Torah says. Esav turned to Yaakov and says, my dear brother, where did you get all of these things? As Rashi says to him in 23, how are you able even to have all these things? This is going against our deal. To which Yaakov responds, Ki chanani Elokim. This is what God has blessed me, what God has graced me. None of these things are really for me. These are all the things that God has given me that I need in my service of God. Where Yaakov understood that this world is but a means for the next world. If you understand money as a means for the next world, as a means to move on in this world, to acquire mitzvot for the next world, so it's not in its own right the money, it's the ability to move on. And that's the famous conversation where Esav says to Yaakov, Yesh li rav, I have a lot, but I could use a lot more. And Yaakov responds to Esav, Yesh li kol, I have everything. Because all that I have is what I need in my service of God at this moment. And he says that was really the struggle between Yaakov and Esav's angel. When Esav's angel saw that Yaakov was going back with these small vessels, he says, oh, he's really into materialistic things. That's not right. That's not what it's all about. The struggle was over. Are you keeping your side of the bargain or not? And then the angel saw, yes, he is keeping his side of the bargain. I'm going to touch him at the hip bone, which many of us should understand as future generations. At least let me get future generations so that they don't understand the message. And that future generations are going to be like Esav, that they're going to try to look at this world as gaining property for themselves and not for an ultimate purpose. And that explains so beautifully in 25, the connection at the end of Parsha Ki Tetzeh, where the Torah tells us you should have just weight. And right after it says you have just weights, it talks about the story how Amalek came. So what's the connection between just weights and Amalek? But that's the whole point, my friends. If you have just weights and you have fair and honest business dealing, and you know that everything you're involved in this world is really going to be in an honest way, and that which is given to you by God, and that which you have is going to be used for God, so then you don't have to worry. Then you'll live a nice life. But if you don't have honest weights and you're trying to take money from other people, So then Esav is going to come in to attack you. Who is Esav's descendant but Amalek? It's up to you. You're not going to have just weights. You're not going to learn the lesson of what Yaakov was trying to instill into his children. So then, my dear friends, Esav is on the way to say, you know what? You've gone over your line in the bargain. The money is really mine. The money is not yours. It's a wonderful story in Rabbi Fran's latest book, Listen to Your Messages. It's a beautiful, beautiful book where he tells him a personal story. He was in South Africa. And a balas tshuva, a woman came over to him and said to him, a story happened to my father that perhaps you could explain to me. He said, okay, I'll listen. She said, my father was not a religious person. My mother came from a more observant family than my father did. But the one thing about my father was he was an honest businessman. In South Africa, the blacks left, right, and center with weights and things. And, you know, they didn't know the difference, and they would, you know, use the scales in their favor. My father was always honest. That was what he was known for. With everyone who came his way, always treated honestly. And my father died, and 20 years later, my mother died. And she, in her will, said that she would like to be buried in Israel and have my father also be reburied in Israel as well. So we, the Chevra Kadisha in Israel, we moved over the body to Israel to have them both buried there. And the Chevra Kadisha was prepared that we're dealing with a body that's been buried for over 20 years. When they moved the body, the Chevra Kadisha said, Shalem Sadiq, this body is intact. It's as if he died just right then. So she said, perhaps you could explain to me, my father was not a Sadiq. He wasn't a righteous person. He wasn't even an observant person. How could you explain this phenomenon? So my friend said, he thought for a minute, and then he answered this. He said, what you did say about your father was that he always treated the scales properly. He had the shalim. He had the scales that always were whole, that were always tzedek, tzedek, that always were righteous. In that respect, since he was so careful and observant about this law, therefore he merited that his body would never decompose and would always be shalim. So we see here, my friends, on a very recent practical story, the importance of this aspect of dealing honestly, fairly, and understanding that money is a gift given to you from God in order to give it really and use it in the proper ways and not to try to take it from others. But now we get back to Sukkot. Yaakov, as soon as he leaves Esav, says, you know what, I know this lesson, but I'm afraid my children won't remember this lesson. So what does he do? As soon as he goes to the next place, immediately it says that he built a house for himself and he built Sukkot for his cattle and he called it Sukkot. Explains to Manah Chaim in 27, the Targum Yonah son translate Bayit as a Beis Medrash, as a place to learn. That's what he built for himself. But while he built a Diras Keva, physical place, a long-standing place for himself, for his cattle, he built a Diras Arayi, he built a temporary dwelling. And he called the place Sukkot, 27 the asterisk, Klomar, Ein l'kinyanei olam hazeh makom keva b'chayenu, to really express this idea that our physical aspects do not really have a place that is keva, that is long-lasting in this world. Ven ein liyot lahut achareyem, we shouldn't pursue them klal. Rak ma shenitzrach lanu olam haba, all that we need only to get us to spiritual goals. And that's why he calls the place immediately after he met Esav, Sukkot. This is the lesson that Yaakov is trying to teach us. That life, after you meet Esav, you might get caught up in the worlds of Esav, the worlds of Rav. No. Understand that I'm not calling the place Bayit. I'm taking my cattle, building Sukkot for them, and calling it Sukkot. And this, my friends, is the lesson of Sukkot. The lesson of Sukkot is it's a temporary dwelling place. It's not forever. We just have to use it as a means to an end. Where the irony comes in, says the Matnas Chaim, is in whose portion did Sukkot eventually land when they divided up the land of Israel? So he says in 28, it landed up in God's section. Who was God? We know Reuven, God, and half of Manasseh were the ones who stayed on the other side of the Jordan. And they said, what? We have a lot of cattle. Let's build houses for our sheep and cattle. And then houses for our family. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, no, no. If you're going to stay on this side of the Jordan, you first build houses for your family and then places for your sheep and cattle. It's not by accident that Sukkot had to land in God's portion, because this is what God had to learn. if you have your priorities mixed up. It's not the money. It's not the cattle. It's not all the grass that you have. What's really important in life is Sukkot, is that you understand this is but a temporary dwelling, and what really matters is one's relationship with God and bringing you from this world to the next. And the final note on this idea, says the Matnas Chaim, is the brother of the tour says that we know that all three festivals are connected with a different avos. Pesach with Abraham, and Yitzchak is Shavuos, the ayil, the blowing of the shofar, and the blowing of the shofar at Matan Torah. And Yaakov is connected to Sukkot. Why? Because of this pasuk that Yaakov moved to Sukkot, right? And he built a place and he called it Sukkot. So it says about Nachaim on a superficial level, just because Yaakov went to a place called Sukkot, you're going to say, okay, the holiday is called Sukkot. What's the connection between the two? But he says, no, on a much deeper level, this is the connection. Because what Yaakov is building in Sukkot is his very essence. He's telling us that's what Sukkot, the holiday, is all about. It's about not focusing in on your life as being permanent, but by the fact that life is but a sukkah, but a temporary dwelling. And he goes so far as to say maybe that's why the holiday is called Sukkot, after the message that Yaakov was trying to teach in the place called Sukkot. So here we have an individual. First idea of life is Yaakov and Yisrael, that the struggles we have in life is not to get caught up in the Yaakovs of life, but of Yisrael, that we have a key to God, that we're able to see God, to able to overcome our struggles. Second idea we've seen in life is that we should look at the physical aspects of life as a Sukkot, as really a challenge. Do we see them as a temporary dwelling, or do we make Sukkot into a bayit like God tried to do? That's our second challenge in life. How do we view Sukkot? How do we view this ability of what our possessions and material aspects in life are all about? We've spoken about a name of a person, and we've spoken about a name of a place. So clearly the third thing we have to speak about is the name of a place as well as the name of a person, the combination of both. And that is none other than our friend, somebody? Shem. You're right, Binyamin is also a place in Israel today. At Sadeka Me'achut. Source 30. Jacob arrives intact at the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, upon arriving from Paddan Aram, and he encamped before the city. And now moving to the next paragraph. Now Dina, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Yaakov, went out to look over the daughters of the land. Shechem, son of Hamor, the Chiti, the prince of the region, saw her, he took her, lay with her, and violated her. He became deeply attached to Dina, daughter of Yaakov. He loved the maiden, appealed to the maiden's emotions. And we know the end of the story is that he agreed to do anything for her. The entire city had a bris milah, and Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, wiped out the entire city. A lot to talk about in this section. And clearly all the difficult issues I'm not going to talk about, because they're difficult issues. That's par for the course. I would like to speak about, though, is the name Shechem. Shechem is a very fascinating place on two levels. On one level, the first place really that Avram Avinu went to when he entered the land and built an altar was Shechem. And we also know, as the Shem Yishmur points out in verse 31, that when the Jewish people came into the land of Israel, when they crossed over the Jordan, Moshe Rabbeinu said to them, take a look at the book of Yoshua, indeed it's so, that they immediately should go to Shechem, to Har Gerizim and Har Eval, and have this major ceremony of the covenant. What is it about Shechem? And here, likewise, the first city that Yaakov reaches when he lands in the land of Israel is Shechem. My friends, what is it about Shechem? Avram's first place, Yaakov's first place, the Jewish people's first place is always Shechem. And then we have to try to understand the personality of this individual called Shechem, who decides that he wants this woman, will do anything to get this woman, and changes the entire city for this woman. I mean, this is a real charismatic young man. What is it about Shechem? So again, as we've spoken about Shem Agarim, the name is the essence. The name of Shechem really tells us the essence about the individual and the essence of the city, and again, a directive for our lives. Let's work through the Shem Yishmur very briefly, source 33. He says that every word in Hebrew language is not just a label, but describes the essence of its subject. The word Shechem, meaning segment or portion, describes the person Shechem and also the place. It is not insignificant that Shechem lived in Shechem. Shechem was the epitome of the character traits displayed by the Shechemites. Each person in Shechem wanted his own portion in life, to be significant and not just part of a larger entity. Shechem was a place which influenced its dwellers and those who came through it to feel that they themselves were important and worthy. A Shechem, which is like a shoulder, right? It means to be a shoulder above. We're on top. We have a section, a certain amount of conceit, a certain amount of pride. And he continues in 34, the Shem Yishmor, where this trait is one of tremendous power. It can be the greatest or the worst of all attributes. On the good side, the individual is exhorted by Chazal to consider that the whole world was created just for him, and that by performing one mitzvah, he can favorably tip the balance of the whole world. The feeling of personal worth in this context is extremely valuable within the mitzvah system. But the converse, however, can be very destructive. A person who misuses his characteristic becomes completely self-oriented. He feels he must stand up for his principles, whatever the cost, whoever mocks or derides him. He ends up clinging to his aim despite the opposition of society and even his God, and becomes an arrogant person. He's so self-assured, he's simply unable to listen to criticism. And in reality, we need a mixture of both. We need to have this idea of feeling strong and having this sense of independence, but we also need to know our place as well. Says the Shem Yishmuel, that is why Shechem is the first place that Avraham Avinu went to, Yaakov Avinu went to, and the Jewish people went to. Because when you come into a new endeavor, a new project in life, you must have that feeling of pride that I can do this. If you're going to walk into a project saying, well, I'm not so sure, it's not going to succeed. There's a certain amount of arrogance that we all need. Maybe arrogance is a strong word, but there's a certain amount of feeling of that we have the Shechem, like a shoulder way above everyone else. I can do this, I can accomplish, I'm going to go forth with a fuller hand when we begin a product. But what they didn't learn is that Avram and Yaakov also had the quality where Avram Avinu says, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I'm nothing but dust and ashes, where Yaakov is the heel. They also have that ability to say, you know what, but we need to learn too. We need to understand that there's a balance in life. We need to understand that maybe we don't know everything. And we'll be willing to listen to criticism, we'll be willing to work with others, and willing to develop. Shechem, the individual, Shechem is a city, has this trait, but really to the extreme of we know what we're going to do, we're going to do it to the best we want to do it, and no one's going to tell us how to do otherwise. It's this real sense of determinism, a sense of we're always right. And that explains the Medrash on the next page. The Medrash says in 38 that Shechem is a place ripe for punishment. There Dina was right. There the sons of Yaakov spoiled themselves over the sale of Yosef, and there the kingdom of Israel was split. I mean, it's not like one of those places you want to move to in life. It's like it seems to be negative there. But says the Shem Yishmuel, don't you see what they all have in common? The above Gemara in 38 only confirms our thesis about Shechem. It is a place which causes those who dwell there to feel self-confident and, if not kept in check, arrogant. Each of the three events which occurred in Shechem were the cases of one group trying to control or gain influence over another, the rape of Dina, the sale of Yosef, which was refusal of the other brothers to feel subordinate to Yosef, choosing instead to dispose of him in order to express their own importance, and the split in the kingdom occurred when one group in the Jewish people refused to bow to the authority of the Davidic kingship and the temple, desiring instead separate autonomous rule. Each of these was clearly influenced by the power of Shechem. Of course, none of this actually reflects bad on Shechem, for the strength with which Shechem empowers its citizens can be used for good purposes as well as bad, which is exactly what we're dealing with in life, that a name has the ability, the essence, to be used positively or negatively. Shechem, we see a personality trait here, which is a very, very important trait in our lives. We need at times to really have that aspect of Shechem, that certain arrogance that we know what we're going to do, we're going to go ahead and do it, particularly at the beginning of a project. But we also need to know how to balance it out, because if it's not in check, so you have the rape of Dina, the sale of the brothers, the split of the kingdom. That's the challenge of the name, that's the challenge of Shechem. Perhaps in conclusion, the name of the Parsha really embodies this challenge that we have in being able to take our missions in life and our names and our essence and really use them to the positive. The name of the parasha is found again in the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe very briefly in the Garden of Torah is Vayishlach. Vayishlach Malachim, and he sent messengers. So he says in 39, an agent's ability to act on behalf of a principal depends on the principal's empowering him to do so. Therefore, if an agent deviates from the instruction of his principal, his agency is revoked. And to be successful, an agent must use his own abilities, devoting his intellect, energy to the task at hand. For even an agent who acts as an extension of his principal appreciates that, in fact, he is a separate entity and must execute the assigned task using his own initiative. And that is really what life is all about. where we are in God's service, where God sends us out in a mission into this world. And in accomplishing this task in 41, we must remember that we are only agents. The world is God's dwelling, and He has outlined His plans for the functioning of that dwelling in the Torah's teaching. Any other conception, however beneficial may appear, is a deviation from our mission. Just like we will send, Yaakov sends out Malachim, he sends out messengers, and this is what they're empowered to do, we too are given a shlichus, we're too given a message from God to accomplish in this world. And we have certain guidelines. We should work within these guidelines. It's like Lama Dover Dome, if we rent somebody's house and they say to you, you know, there's a sprinkler system on at a certain time, and that's the way we need it. You know, I want it at 4 in the morning for 10 minutes. So you're in this person's house, and, you know, you're there for maybe 2 weeks, let's say, and you say, that's really silly. Why should it be on at 4 in the morning only for 10 minutes? I'll turn it on every hour for, you know, 20 minutes. So that might be what we call seichel, but it's not what the person wanted. It's not your house, my friends. That's where it's at in life. God wants it on 4 o'clock in the morning for 10 minutes. Well, we wouldn't even think of messing around with the clock, because that's the way the world is about. We're just here as visitors in God's world. Nonetheless, God expects us to use our own initiative to accomplish this task. He gives us the tools in which to know what we're doing. And this is the message of Parsha Vayishlach, that every one of us is a shaliach, an agent of God. We are sent to Esav to refine and reveal the godliness within the material existence that is identified with Esav. Vayishlach is the name of the Torah reading. The name of an entity reflects its essence. Thus, every element of the reading is connected with this concept, highlighting the many facets of the mission with which we are charged. For being engaged on a mission to make the world God's dwelling challenges us to encompass every aspect of existence. And that, perhaps, in conclusion, is what Vayishlach is really about. Vayishlach is really the paradigm of God sending us. Like Yaakov sends an angel to Esav with a certain mission, God, Vayishlach, sends us with a certain mission in this world to meet Esav, to be able to confront Esav. Like in last week, the soul had to confront Lavan. And the way to confront Esav in this world, the way to confront Esav really represents the challenges in this world, is, I think, the threefold level that we mentioned today. To understand that we are who we are by our essence, by our names, and that signifies what makes us special. And then the three-pronged approach is to know that life is full of struggle. Sometimes there's samal, sometimes there's michal. Sometimes there's struggles to keep us in check, sometimes there's struggles to move us onward in life. But to always remember the name Yisrael, that we connect ourselves to God, and that struggles are meant to move us onward and not to make us depressed. We throw away the Gid HaNasha. On the second level in life, to understand that the struggles of Esav in life is a struggle of the monetary world we live in, the physical aspects we live in, and that we have to keep in mind the lesson of Sukkot. The lesson is that we take a look at this world as but a means to an end and not an end in itself. It's Sukkot, it's a temporary dwelling, and it's not the bayit, it's not the physical dwelling of a permanent house. And finally, the challenge in life is to understand that in life we need to have an aspect of Shechem within us. We need to have a certain amount of audacity, a certain amount of feeling of authoritative power, particularly when we begin a project. Product. Third time. But there is an important thing to remember, is that it has to be checked, it has to be kept in balance. And that if we're not going to take the positive aspects that we have in life, then we're very able to slip and to fall. And that's the message of Vayishlach, to take ourselves as emissaries from God, to take our name, to take that which is special about us, and use the name as a challenge for the positive, as the binyamin, and not to get caught up in the benoni, not to get caught up in depression and the negative aspects of life.